undergraduate degree in government, history, and economics. Mr. Mott Wiseman went on to receive 2 degrees from McGill Law School. Soon after, he embarked on a career encompassing both public policy and public advocacy. During his early days in Ottawa, his involvements were diverse, ranging from directing a Privy Council-sponsored report on the access to justice in Canada to acting as a member of the Canadian Consultative Commission on Multiculturalism. Mr. Wiseman expanded to the international stage, specifically with regard to the issues of urban development, social housing, and public finance. He has acted as a consultant on important infrastructure and job creation programs in the United States, France, Brazil, and Venezuela, bringing together employers, major unions, and city administrations. Bringing his experience to bear here at home, he has built the Institute for Public Affairs of Montreal into Canada's largest public interest advocacy alliance. As founder and president, Mr. Wiseman has guided it into providing institutional assistance and advice on the critical 3 H's of social ills: health, hunger, and homelessness. Mr. Wiseman considers the Institute's most unique achievement to be its success in bringing big business and big labor together in common cause with activists to represent the most unempowered and disenfranchised in society. Building on his belief that media and activism go hand in hand, he launched in 2005 what is now the Metropolitan. A year later, he began his critically acclaimed Last Angry Man radio show. He then broadened the marriage of media and social activism by taking on the editorship of The Suburban, shifting his emphasis to advocacy journalism. A frequent commentator in the electronic medium, he has appeared on CNN, CTV, and CBC, just to name a few. As well, his opinions and views have been published in numerous prominent print media publications, including Time Magazine, The New York Times, The National Post, and The Jerusalem Post. Mr. Wiseman is also the recipient of the Martin Luther King Jr. Award for the Promotion of Human Dignity. As is evident by this small fraction of his resume, Mr. Wiseman passed 30 years in the intersecting realms of politics, community activism, and media have been as effective as they have been diverse. So, without further ado, please help me to welcome the keynote speaker of McMahon 2012, Mr. Beryl Wiseman.
Dignity and the comportment and the organization of all of you here, it would not be out of government. So, yay, all of you. Michaela, thank you for that introduction. I want to sincerely thank Nir and Anik for the opportunity to speak to all of you. I do a lot of speaking. And in many of these places, there are people of power and privilege and preference and influence. And there have been prime ministers and ministers and others. It is far more important to speak to an audience like you. Nir spoke of change. We have used that word too much. We have cheapened its meaning. But in speaking to an audience like this, you are a parliament of the world. And you're not going to hear necessarily encouraging things from me. I don't have an optimistic view of things. There's a place for optimism. But tonight, I want you to hear what have been my truths. And not just in the things that I've done that my family has described to you, but how information has affected my life and others in the realm of international relations and in the realm of intelligence. You're not going to be necessarily comforted by these words, but you will be challenged by these words. Each of you here is privileged, and I don't mean that in the sense that all of you here have a check from Daddy to make your life at university easy. Many of you work. But each of you here, through the people that you will meet, through the commitments that you have made, through the knowledge that you have absorbed, will have a responsibility. You too belong in that group, of whom it has been said, to those to whom much is given, from them much is expected. One thing that will be expected from all of you when you go to the four corners of the world is that you stand for what's true. Is that you don't balance interests, you challenge interests. Is that if you understand one fundamental idea, it is not to fall in love with the current PR. The theme of your conference is information, the new currency of international relations. And it is a noble and appropriate theme. But let me start to blaspheme. The real theme should be disinformation, the very old currency of international relations, and the very real danger to so many of you in the home countries you come from and here in Canada. That is your challenge. You are all here capable of affecting, if not change, partnerships in all of mankind's transcendent yearning for redemptive change. Change is a word, is like sail, 50% up. What kind of change? The kind of change that Bobby Kennedy spoke about in Soweto in 1965, when he said, and that and what he said could be a description of your responsibility in this room. You don't get out of here scot-free. And what he said was that from 1,000 centers of energy and daring, you can will a difference. You can throw a pebble into the calm lake of apathy and lethargy. And those pebbles can create a wave that will tear down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. That is your challenge. That is what I want you to take away from here tonight, at least from my comments. I don't want you to be comfortable. I don't want your minds tonight. If in the next half hour I touch your hearts and I touch your spirit, that will be enough. I want you to walk away with some feeling. You know, international relations is not a science. Yes, I went through it too. It's not, they're wrong. International relations is an art, and it is the art of the management of people. The recognition of which aspirations are noble and which are not. The ability to bring together diverse groups and explain to them what is possible and what should not even be considered. And more than anything, regardless of what price you may pay in terms of career or advancement, the responsibility of speaking truth to power. Never think for a moment, never have that wonderful thought that comes across all our minds of anybody who's in public affairs, and you are all in public affairs, that it's okay when I get into power, I'll make a difference. You won't, because compromise starts there, and you are worth much less than when you started. You make a difference going in. There is a story told of a Persian king. The king had two sons. And one son, the eldest, was quite brilliant and shrewd. His brilliance was the manipulation of the public treasury. His brilliance was in the devious art of court politics. And of course, being the eldest, he assumed that he would be named the successor to his father. The second son was wise and learned and studied But he wanted no part of court politics. He didn't believe that the progress of his people could be achieved from an ivory tower. So he would spend his days going among the poor in the marketplace. He would spend his treasure helping the sick. And one day, his father announced his decision as to who would succeed him. And it was to the youngest son that he gave that honor. And the oldest son could not understand, and he went to him, "Father, I have served you so well. I have learned the ways of your life. Why do you give the succession to my younger brother? Is this what the people need? I have the brain." And his father said to him, "A heart the people need for a king. A soul the people need for a king." Reason is important. The mind is important. But not if it is devoid or annulled. The heart and the spirit that makes us different from the animals and is at the heart of any social contract. This conference takes place at a very special time in the calendar. I'm not a particularly religious or observant person, but the past 2 weeks are the days of my faith. They need to be the days of yours to understand the new currency are merely the cloaks of the old treacheries. Tomorrow is the 67th anniversary, commemoration is a better word, of the liberation of Auschwitz. Tomorrow. Now, it is important enough in itself to remember. But in terms of the theme of this conference, of what you will be considering, the idea that disinformation is the old currency and must be discussed, and you must find the ways to examine it, to find it, and to respond to your people about it. We get very excited with the information revolution. Citizen journalism. Near reference, the Arab Spring, people in the streets. This is not new. The speed is new. But do we really get the truth? In 1917, Lenin said, "Revolution is repetition." He said, "Give Trotsky the army, give me a printing press." 1917. What was important about Auschwitz in terms of this conference, besides the fact that you saw, and you must remember, that the most civilized nation on earth and degenerated to hell? That information or disinformation was not used at its most effective by modern technology. It is not today that we have seen the greatest, and when I say the greatest, I don't mean the best, I mean the most effective, even though tragic consequences of it. It was in the 40s. And Auschwitz's creation was the result of a regime whose minister of propaganda, Joseph Goebbels, said, "Repeat a big lie often enough and the broad mass of the people will believe it." He was right. He was not right in his lies, he was right in the tactics. And Auschwitz was liberated by the Soviet Union, whose leader, Joseph Stalin, mimicked the same words. Information as the new currency of international relations. Disinformation as the old currency that is the greatest threat to international stability. It is 50 years since President Kennedy warned us that we live in an age of instant communication and instant destruction. You need to remember that. You may ask yourselves, what's he talking about? Today, nobody could get away with murder. We see it everywhere. Except, of course, you all know that's not true. Let me work backwards. The Arab Spring. We saw brave images. We saw citizen journalists. Do we today see what has happened to the liberals who led those revolutions? And I say liberals with small l. Do you hear one word of the murder, the torture, the marginalization of the liberals across North Africa and the Levant? And yet they are being marginalized and imprisoned everywhere. Erwin Kotler has said in so many places, in so many audiences, Holocausts begin with words, not with bullets. We witnessed that in Montreal this week with the deportation of Leon Mugesera, the man who sparked the butchery of Rwanda, with a speech. A speech. Why don't we hear about what's happened to liberals in all these regimes? Because disinformation is, as always, the old currency of international relations. Disinformation is what your generation, all of us, everybody has to guard against. Disinformation is something you feel in your gut because you have decency. You merely need leaders to show you courage to use it because you learned it at your mother's knee. Disinformation is what you need to tell your leaders wherever you go. This far and no further, the emperor has no clothes. Disinformation has the old currency. Disinformation provides simply new clothes for the old tyrannies. CBS recently did a study in China of 20-year-olds. And of hundreds of students, two remember Tiananmen Square. Two even heard the name. Two remember the image of the lone young man standing in front of a tank. Because that nation suppresses information, suppresses free speech, suppresses free thought. Information cannot be celebrated in a vacuum. We cannot merely say, this will not happen again, because we instantly see it. And clearly the world will rally. The world has a conscience. No, the world has no conscience. The world has interests. You, each one of you, have a conscience. And if you sell your conscience for career or advancement without conditions, then each generation is lost. You cannot simply go forward and say, well, look, I was part of that committee in the UN that allowed that to happen. We help the rebels in Tunisia. We help the people on the streets of Libya. Without at the same time examining that not only has this organization, the noblest and best hope of man, been led down to such a low limitation of narrow circumstance that it does not even know how to drag itself out of its own lies and deceit. We sit here, as Nir eloquently said, entering 4 days where you will be discussing how to make life better. You know what the biggest issue at the UN is this weekend? How to get itself out of a PR fandango that it could never imagine. Because as Nir was just saying and sharing what we all felt, the hope for people throughout the Middle East, Two months ago, my friends, at the height of dozens of people being killed in the streets of Homs and Damascus in Syria, Syria was elected to the executive of UNESCO and elected to the 5-person executive committee of its human rights organization. Only 3 days ago, the UN Watch in Geneva managed to cobble together an alliance of democratic nations who have now convinced the United Nations to put a stop to this. Information, imagery, can be deadly. How can we, on the one hand, all of us in this room, whether working inside United Nations organizations or outside of them, have passionately advocated for the end of the Assad regime, have passionately advocated for more transparency, have passionately advocated for an end to government based on theocratic tyranny? At the same time, are we going to sit idly by when the very organization that all you represent doesn't know what its left hand is doing from its right? Is the point of information as the new currency of international relations merely to be a leverage? Well, if we tell the world that you're good, you'll be good. Well, Mr. Assad, you're on UNESCO. You're there now. No, my friends, that's not the way it happens. And that's not why so much blood has been shed. Because the currency of international relations has been, always will be, blood and courage. It can be nothing else. You know, there have only been, strangely enough, 3 periods, just 3, in the modern international system, just three foundations upon which it's been built. The first, in the 17th century, was the Peace of Westphalia that put an end to the 30 Years' War. That peace spoke of only one thing, and one thing only. Don't worry, I'm not doing the speech, I just wanted to quote. Sovereignty. After 30 years of war, European nations concluded that if sovereignty, physical sovereignty, would be respected, maybe they wouldn't kill each other anymore. But what that Peace of Westphalia imposed was collective fiat. Amazing things started to happen in Europe around the same time. There was a rejection of collective fiat, order, physical sovereignty, the imposition of collective thought was not enough for some people. And in the midst of the middle of that century, at the same time that the leaders and the barons and the kings and the dukes were making that Peace of Westphalia, 2 men. One, a social outcast in London for his views, named John Locke. The other, a man who had been excommunicated from his community, named Benedict Spinoza in Amsterdam, conceived of what is till today man's last best hope, the idea of liberalism. No, not political party liberalism. Not the liberalism of the salons, the people who think that the only problems left in the world are that they're not enough to fight that. The liberalism that says that society exists for the fullest flowering of individual possibility unhindered and unhampered by collective fiat. And as much as today we celebrate Locke and Spinoza, as much as today we teach in universities how their ideas open the way for Rousseau, for Jefferson, for Thomas Paine, for the survival and success of liberty, then they were outcasts. That information is the new currency forever and a day of the international system. The idea that we exist and our public efforts exist for the protection of the weakest, For those societies who respected the rights of the individual, ipso facto respected the rights of every collective. Those societies who imposed the rights of the collective in the name of some greater good on each individual ended up in slaughter. Because one collective could have a wonderful, cherished dream of brotherhood. The other guy's collective is gassing 300,000 Kurds in northern Iraq. And the world stays silent. Because the Kurds didn't have oil. The Kurds didn't have a nation that they had been promised since the Treaty of Versailles. So we had 250 years where the idea of sovereignty was paramount. Words matter, my friends. Words matter. Sovereignty was disinformation. Sovereignty was simply a temporary respite where the powerful could remain powerful in their corners. Then we have World War II.
Veuillez nous suivre, s'il vous plaît.
L'Altima de Nissan avec clé intelligente. Plus d'innovation, ça donne moins de frustration. C'est ça, la loi du gros bon sens.
Organizing principle. That didn't change till the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations that followed. And what did the League of Nations talk about? The League of Nations talked about peace and order. Not liberty, not justice, not freedom, not individualism. Peace and order. We've butchered 30 million people. We've destroyed the best of a generation. Let's end it. It was kind of a weariness, the Westphalian weariness. But at least it overcame one thing. It overcame the sanctity of sovereignty, under which so many tyrannies demand obedience. Then came World War II. And it was clear after that war, where the most civilized nation on earth, the home of Beethoven and Goethe and Nietzsche, descended into madness, that more would have to come into the popular vocabulary. The words that make up information, the words of sovereignty, the words of peace and order were not sufficient. We needed justice. We needed freedom, and we needed respect for the individual. 300 years after the Westphalian peace, the world finally got it for one brief shining moment. And the words that the world got were written just up the hill. Just up the hill. In the halls of McGill, in the halls of Clausewitz. Young man named John Peters Humphrey had the privilege and honor to draft the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I know you've all heard it, but I want to read three phrases. You've studied it, but I want you to listen to it. Don't just hear it. Listen to it with your hearts, not your minds. Don't discount the hopes of 1947 and 1948. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights said, recognize the inherent dignity and the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family. One. Equal and inalienable rights. Human family. Family is composed of what? Come on, this can be Socratic. What? A family is composed of what? Individuals. In another paragraph, all human beings, freed individuals, are born free and equal in dignity and rights and endowed with reason and conscience. Now that may have been quite an assumption, to assume that all individuals have reason and conscience, but that is what we have to strive for. And finally, everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security as a person. For the first time in human history, there was a new currency of the international system. Information is words. And for the first time, the international system was founded on the principle individual work and the responsibility of individual conscience. And do you know why the United Nations worked for the first 10 years? That's why I called it one brief shining moment. Because for the first decade, they really tried. For the first decade, membership was not automatic. There had to be minimum standards of civility in a nation that wanted membership. And then, in the 60s, in the midst of all the revolutions, people marching, young people marching for justice. It wasn't just for the Vietnam War. Freedom riders in the South. Information? The world saw those images of young freedom riders being beaten. It didn't stop the fact that 11 days ago, in these days that should sear our souls, it would have been the 83rd birthday of Martin Luther King Jr. It didn't stop the fact that he got his head blown off on the balcony of a cheap motel in Memphis, demonstrating the individual dignity of garbage workers. The world saw the images. Where was justice? What was being done to undermine these glorious words? What was being done to undermine the words that are written on the plaza in front of the United Nations, the first noblest idea of a united world spoken by a prophet in the streets of Jerusalem? And they shall turn their swords into plowshares, and nations shall not make war upon nation anymore. Well, the images of the freedom riders, the images of Dr. King getting the Nobel Prize, were as window dressing. Just as today, the images we have in our minds are of the Arab Spring, of the brave liberals in the streets, but we have no images of what is being done to them as theocratic governments take hold across the middle rim of this small planet. So then, in the 60s and 70s, when people in the West, young people in the West, all of you here would have been in the streets, were marching for social justice and the rights of the individual, deals were being made. Deals were being made and a return of the international system back to Westphalian standards. It started with oil. It started with the abandonment by Western interests, who had discovered oil in the Middle East, who had organized the oil production process, who had given jobs, who had given money. And don't boo oil. This is not a matter of industry being wrong and everybody else being right. This was a fight in the Middle East between the sheikhs and the corporations. And they both got into bed together. We had sovereignty anew. It was decided that natural resources on the international level had nothing to do with the individuals who discovered it, that individual effort would not be rewarded, that merely because it was discovered in some physical place, it belonged there. Back to Westphalia. In 1973, the newly wealthy nations formed OPEC, that I assure you has more power than the United Nations. And at the same time, Western business interests, who informationally and in public images condemn those organizations, in fact did business with them, and in fact pushed their governments to allow open trade with Eastern Europe. So after 30 years of fighting against tyranny, after the last best hope of man talking about the universal rights of man, the very nations that had won the war were about to lose the peace to interests who cared not a whit about the sacrifices that had been paid for individual work. But you know, in the middle of the 70s, in the middle of this push, globalization isn't 10 years old. Globalization is 35 years old. It started in the 70s. Two brave men stood up in Congress in the United States. Senator Henry Jackson and Congressman Charles Bannock of Ohio. And they passed something called the Jackson-Bannock Amendment. And over the objections of presidents and corporate leaders, it said, America will not do business with tyrannies. It said, you don't get Mr. Corporate America. You don't get to use the cheap labor of Eastern Europe until they free their people. 5 years later, the nations of the Western world who had won the war and now understood they might lose the peace, signed what was called the Helsinki Accord, the Helsinki Final Act. And more than Reagan's Star Wars and more than Reagan's outspending of the Soviet Union on defense, it was the morality of those actions that could not be denied by the legislatures, the parliaments, and the congresses of the various nations of the free world that stopped the West from doing business with tyranny. Those actions, more than anything, led to the fall of Eastern Europe. Those actions, more than anything, two brave men, led to 20 new democracies on the European continent. And in fact, as imperfect as Russia is, it is certainly a lot better than the Gulag Archipelago that it was. But we stand today on the brink of yet another moral bankruptcy. A moral bankruptcy that started some 10 years ago, when under a progressive American president, interests who were not at all engaged with human dignity, but who gave information into the international system that the way to go was further globalization, those interests said, forget Jackson-Bannock, forget Helsinki Final Act. We need cheap labor, and we're going to do this with